Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. When it comes to matters involving intelligence, yes, but common sense as well, about immigration, it's always our privilege to turn to the superb folks at the Center for Immigration Studies. Dr. Stephen Camerota serves as the Director of Research for CIS and has been a guest with us frequently in 2017. We're delighted to welcome him back at the beginning of 2018 and hope that we'll talk with him a lot in the course of this year as well. Dr. Camerota, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been working, you and your colleagues, now for quite some time to educate the rest of us about immigration writ large, legal as well as illegal, and the impact it has, the sheer numbers of people that are being brought into this country on, well, our social fabric, our economy, our political life, and the like. Could you give us a sense, Dr. Camerota, of how large is this infusion? And if you can, any sense of from whence many of these folks are coming?
Right. So overall, about 1.5 million people settle in the United States permanently each year. That's legally and illegally. It wouldn't include the tourists or business travelers and things like that. Overall, projections show that immigration will add about 100 million people to the U.S. population over the next half century. There's a lot of agreement on that. My own projections, those by the Census Bureau, Pew Research, all pretty much show about that level, give or take. So that gives you some idea of the scale. Maybe a substantive way of thinking about it, just looking at people who would be legal immigrants and be old enough to vote and be here long enough to naturalize and then be able to vote. Over the next 20 years, immigration can add about 15 million potential new voters to the United States.
And that relative to a population of about 300 million or so as it stands right now is a very dramatic impact. Where do most of these people come from, can you say?
Well, the vast majority of people coming to the United States, and has been for more than half a century, come from the developing world. Places like Europe or Canada do send some immigrants to the United States, Great Britain, Eastern Europe, Canada, but most people don't come from places like that. Most people come from the poorer countries. It was about half of new arrivals had been coming from Latin America, with Mexico being the top sending country, still is. And again, we're talking about total immigration, legal and illegal. But now, Latin America is still the top sending region, but it's fallen off to more like a third. And East Asia, like China, the Philippines, Korea, and Vietnam, that'd be East Asia, and then South Asia, or the Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, these three regions have taken over. The Middle East and Africa have also increased, but the majority of U.S. immigrants now come from East Asia and South Asia and Latin America. Those three regions are the biggest.
Yeah. Now, the president rather colorfully, and some have said quite disdainfully, talked about some of the places that some of these folks are coming from. We won't use the term that he allegedly used. He denies it on the air. But suffice it to say, the point he was making, as I understand it, is that such folks are inherently more likely to be difficult to assimilate into our country simply because of the skills they bring, in some cases at least, and the cultural and sociological experiences that are quite different from those of this country. As you at the Center for Immigration Studies see it, what are the societal implications of an infusion of folks with those kinds of characteristics in a society like ours?
It CIS, we don't do really much research on culture per se, but it's an interesting question. Obviously, part of the reason the less developed world is less developed is its institutions. And the institutions, governmental, business, and so forth, in those societies certainly does reflect the culture. So it is a fair question to wonder, what does large-scale immigration mean to the United States of people who come from societies with weak, say, political institutions? Could that impact our institutions here? The issue that I think is very relevant is, if you allow in a lot of folks who don't have a lot of education, since education is the best predictor of socioeconomic success in the United States, a large fraction of those who come without much education are going to struggle. And as a result, overall, because such a large fraction of immigrants don't have a lot of education, a lot of immigrants struggle. So just to give you two quick statistics, about one-third of all the children in America today who are in poverty live in an immigrant family. A little over half of all immigrant households in America access one or more of the nation's welfare programs, that is, households headed by immigrants.
Stephen Camerata is our guest. We're talking about his work at the Center for Immigration Studies, which includes a recent paper about another feature of immigrant communities, non-citizens, according to your analysis, between 2011 and 2016, committed a disproportionate share of federal crimes. Steve, talk a little bit about that. Is it unique to the federal crimes, or is it true of state and local crimes as well?
Yeah, so the question of immigrant crime is a complicated one, and the big complication is state and local governments, where most of the law enforcement goes on in the United States, do not generally keep strict track of the citizenship or immigration status of the people they arrest or incarcerate or convict. So we don't really have a clear picture at the state and local level. Oh, I've written a long report of how muddled the picture is. There is one place that does keep track. And there what we find is that even when we exclude immigration crimes, about 21% of people convicted and sentenced for non-immigration crimes in the last 5 years at the federal level were not U.S. citizens, but not people who are not U.S. citizens are only about 8% of the adult population. So again, 8% of the population, but about 21% of those committing non-immigration crimes. And so that would seem to indicate a disproportionate amount of criminality at the federal level. Of that 8%, about 4% are illegal immigrants, and about 4% are non-citizens, but they're green card holders. They're here legally.
Let me just ask you, as you've laid out this picture, it's pretty clear that one of the things that we're experiencing through this process is a tremendous infusion of folks who may, in one way or another, be problematic. It comes as we're having a very vigorous debate, as you know, about DACA, the idea of giving some sort of status quite quickly to as few as 800,000 so-called kids, and perhaps quite a larger number of their accompanying or at least related adults. Just quickly, your assessment of the advisability of that step.
Well, I mean, to remind your listeners, these are people who are supposed to have come to the United States before the age of 16. President Obama did something that many people think was unconstitutional. He just said, I'm not going to enforce the law on these folks. They're people who brought here by their parents mostly. And I'm going to instead give them work authorization and permission to be here on a temporary basis. Donald Trump has ended that program, but they're trying to create a legislation that would do in law, which is what Obama should have done originally. If we decide to legalize folks, two quick things. One, it's not a high-skilled population. Only about 15% of the adults have at least a two-year college degree. We can't expect that there are going to be some sort of large fiscal or economic benefit to the United States, but we might want to do it on humanitarian grounds. But if we do it, we need to do it as a package. If you legalize folks, you just encourage more illegal immigration. That's why we need more enforcement at the border, but also in the interior of the United States, particularly going after the employers who hire illegal immigrants to deter people from coming if we legalize. The second thing we need to do is get rid of the chain migration categories so that when these newly legalized DACA people eventually become citizens, they won't be able to sponsor their relatives, including the parents who are the true guilty party here, no one wants to reward. So getting rid of the chain migration categories, which lets you bring in your brothers and sisters and your parents and so forth, makes a lot of sense in the context of DACA, as does additional enforcement. So kind of as a full package, I think it would make sense. And the president has pushed for that, but the Democrats have not been supportive.
The question, again, though, occurs, are we witnessing through this process, not just DACA, but more broadly, as you've described it, Steve Kamrat, a fundamental transformation of America? And I think there's a lot of reason to be concerned about that. We appreciate so much the work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies and your time today. Steve, come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, as promised, Michael Cutler joins us, former Immigration and Naturalization Service expert on these matters. We'll get his take on it as well right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us, as we frequently do when we're talking about matters involving immigration and our security, the border and on the interior, Michael Cutler. Michael is a veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, where he served with great distinction for some 30 years and capped it with work as well with the Drug Enforcement Agency and U.S. Customs, and really has a firsthand understanding of what the challenges we face are from legal as well as illegal immigration. It is always a delight to see his writings at places like Front Page Magazine and Family Security Matters. You can hear him on his own blog radio show, the Michael Cutler Hour. And we're always pleased when he spends a little time with us. Michael, welcome back. Good to have you.
Frank, always great joining you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let me ask you, Michael, we talked with Steve Camerata in the previous segment a little bit about this, but I'd like to get your drill down on it as well. There is, it would appear, safe to say, a fundamental transformation of America taking place with the infusion of large numbers of people, many of whom the president has pointed out are coming from countries very different than our own. There is an argument to be made that that diversity enhances, the fabric of America. There's also an argument to be said, as Steve Camerata did, that it may not work out so well for us. Give us your view, if you would, sort of as an introduction to the topic of how this is working out.
Fair question. 10 years ago, the Congressional Budget Office made the point that it costs 20 to 40% more to educate kids who can't speak, read, or write English. We are living in a world of economic difficulties and a country of economic difficulties. Schools very often can't provide basic services for their own students. Kids with special needs certainly suffering, because so much more money keeps getting poured into English as a second language programs that wouldn't be necessary had we not been inundating our schools with kids who can't speak, read, or write English. And that's not a statement of xenophobia. It's a statement of fact. We don't need a common religion or ethnicity. I'm a New Yorker. I'm Jewish. I'm part of America's smallest minority. I love diversity. But there's a difference between loving diversity and putting ourselves into a position where we're turning America into a Tower of Babel. We need a common language that unites a country. And today, increasingly, English is not necessarily the language you may encounter in dealing with so many folks who now live among us.
And that may be just the tip of the iceberg, as they say, with a lack of shared values, with a lack of understanding of or commitment to our Constitution and the political system that it supports. Let me ask you then, as you talk about specifically this problem of DACA, Michael Cutler, you have described it as a Trojan horse, an immigration Trojan horse, and I'm interested in how that works and to what effect in light of the dynamics you're describing.
Sure, and that's my article for Front Page Mag, my most recent article. Look, this isn't about kids. Let's be blunt about it. This was about doing an end run again around failed comprehensive immigration reform, bad legislation. I testified for three House, one Senate hearing about that issue. And in an article for the Washington Times, I came to call it Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. The notion of providing millions of illegal aliens who did not enter undocumented. That is a pretend word. It's Orwellian. It's not about political correctness. They entered without inspection. They snuck in because they know they belong to one or more categories of aliens who are excludable. And it's not based on race, religion, or ethnicity. Our laws are blind about those superficial issues. It's about criminals, terrorists, spies, human rights violators, fugitives from justice. So we don't know who they are, and suddenly we would have been forced to provide identity documents without the capacity to interview them, let alone do field investigation. And if it was really about the children, because this was the follow-on, you know, we had the DREAM Act. Why was the DREAM Act supposed to cover aliens as old as 35 years of age if this is about the kids? Demographers back then did a study and found that age 35 would put over 90% of the illegal alien population under that huge umbrella. All they had to do was claim they came as children. Everyone calls this DACA, declared a deferred action childhood arrival. There's a C that's missing. Claimed childhood arrival with few, if any, interviews, no field investigations. There's no way of knowing when someone ran the border. It's easy for someone who's been here for 7 days to claim to have been here for 7 years. And immigration fraud was identified by the 9/11 Commission as the key entry and embedding tactic of terrorists repeatedly, not just the 9/11 hijackers. So we have this population of 800,000 illegal aliens, many of whom can be as old as 36 today because Mr. Obama created this program back in 2012 and established the age of 31 as the cutoff. And by the way, how do you determine if someone is really 31 or 33 or 35? Again, no interview, no field investigation. We can't verify their identity. So this was really an end run to sneak comprehensive reform through the process when repeatedly Congress rejected it. And by the way, talking about fraud, didn't Mr. Obama claim in that Rose Garden speech back then Congress failed to act? Voting no is not a failure to act. It's the Congress exercising its constitutional authority to vote down what they believe is bad legislation. And indeed, this was terrible.
This was indeed. Michael, you have also been very, I think, forthright, shall we say. In fact, quite clarion, blunt may serve as well, in warning that you are watching through this process a kind of political transformation as well, that what seems to be operating, in fact, the Center for American Progress apparently actually acknowledged as much, an effort to change the electorate of the United States. Walk us through how that works, and again, what are the implications?
Well, look, Donald Trump was elected for a simple reason. I mean, maybe some people don't want to admit it. Maybe they don't like his gruff manner of speaking. My dad was a construction worker. I grew up with construction workers. That's the world that Donald Trump grew up in. Also, these guys are blunt. They don't see shades of gray near as much as they see issues as black and white. So some people maybe voted for him and then tried to keep a low profile. But people voted for Trump because he promised to secure the borders and start enforcing immigration laws. We've been importing far more foreign workers than the number of new jobs we've been creating. Not just bottom rung for illegal aliens, the H-1B visa program. We've seen wages and jobs go away. We've seen Americans who are highly skilled, highly experienced being fired, forced to train their replacements from India. We're looking at articles where we're told that 150,000 Chinese students are now studying science, technology, engineering, math, STEM curriculum, going back to China, building their military. People look at this and say, what are we doing? This is an act of suicide. Why do we have drugs pouring into the United States and all the violence that goes with it? So the American voter is getting on to what's happening. You know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So the Democratic Party has apparently done the math. And where the wheels came off the wagon, the Democratic Party that used to stand with American workers, which is why I'm registered as a Democrat, full disclosure, can't tell you the last time I voted for one, they've stopped supporting American workers, and American workers are increasingly turning their back on the Democratic Party. The only way for the Democratic Party to survive is to import new voters who will feel beholden to them and keep them in power. You know, I'm not a Bible student, but we talk about the wisdom of Solomon, and he knew the real mom had never hurt a hair on the head of her own child. Think about what politicians are willing to do to America to keep in power. What a betrayal, wouldn't you say?
Well, I certainly would. And again, the question that occurs is, will Americans enable this to continue? And clearly, a good-sized part of the population is good with it, but there's a majority, it would appear, that recognizes this is, as you say, Michael Cutler, a suicide pact, and we can't afford to go down that road. Michael, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your work and your willingness to come and talk about it here at Secure Freedom Radio from time to time. We'll look forward to doing so again in the very near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and come back to us soon. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman about economic warfare. It's hotting up. What it means for you, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio, on matters involving economic warfare. And Kevin is deeply skilled in this subject matter. He is the author of a terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. He's also the author of two best-selling books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He is also a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very proud to say, and a weekly guest here. Kevin, it's good to have you.
Great to be here, Frank.
Well, economic warfare being your portfolio, it certainly seems as though there are more and more indications that this is amping up in the world today, specifically with respect to communist China. As we've talked about, Kevin, this is very much a feature of the president's new national security strategy that China is, in fact, engaged in economic warfare against us. What's the latest evidence of that, and does it portend?
Well, however you look, it becomes obvious that we're already in an economic war, and the fear is that it could go to a hot war at some point. But in terms of economic war, we see in today's Wall Street Journal, there's a big article on trade war with China. This is something that a few years ago they told us, oh, it's not possible. It's a symbiotic relationship. We'll always be friends and so forth. And that was the business community trying to sell China to the rest of America and to the politicians. But the fact is that we're locked in a desperate trade war with them. And it's gotten so sophisticated, as the journal article points out, that the Chinese could target specific congressional districts to undermine the president or undermine any political effort so that they could force the Chinese view on us. So they target a part of an economy in a congressional district. They dump goods or services to affect it, or they stop buying from that area. It weakens that area, and it causes the populace then to vote out the bums as they see them. So it's very, very sophisticated trade war, something we've never seen before.
Another aspect of it is that there's a report today that the Chinese are looking, I guess it's actually now a day or two old, but the Chinese are looking at slowing or even halting purchases of U.S. treasuries. Kevin, I know that there's been some talk of this for a while. Is this more than talk at this point, do you think?
Well, it's always saber-rattling. They reported we may slow our purchases, and then they came out shortly after and said, oh, that was just a misunderstanding. That's not what we're doing. No, it is what they're doing. They are using their holdings of American debt as a weapon of power against the United States interests, to further their own interest. But it is a very real weapon. And just as an example, we saw a quick tick up in interest rates when that report came out. Right now, if we're paying 2% interest on a $20 trillion federal debt, we're paying $400 billion a year in interest. If that rate went back to 6%, which is a very normal rate for a 10-year bond or a 30-year bond, and we had to pay 6% to borrow, our interest payments would be $1.2 trillion a year. They know they have a formidable weapon, and they continued to tell us that they will use it when necessary.
And are there specific things, as you see it, Kevin, that are prompting this kind of saber rattling in the economic space at this particular moment in time? Does this have to do with the trade disagreements we have with them, or perhaps disagreements over North Korea or other considerations?
they're going to use the current timing. They're going to blame President Trump, no matter what it is, because they know that that is popular with the American left and the American media. So they're going to say Trump because he uses the wrong word referencing countries, because he's done certain actions on immigration or whatever. They will blame it on President Trump regardless. But the fact is, this is a plan that they began putting in place starting in 1999, and they are now to the point where they feel large enough, powerful enough, and comfortable enough that they can initiate very strong means of economic war, and they are fully prepared to go into full-blown war.
I want to come back to that in a minute, but just staying with the economic side, there's also a report, Kevin Freeman, that China's appetite for Russian oil is beginning to have a bite in Europe in terms of the prices that the Europeans are paying for energy from one of their principal suppliers, the Russians. How does that operate in this whole dynamic equation? Are the Chinese deliberately calculating that they can squeeze the Europeans at the same time they're squeezing the Americans, or is it just they're focused narrowly on meeting their own energy requirements and the devil take the hindmost for anybody else?
Well, I think it's actually a third option, which is Russia and China colluded several years ago when the price of oil was lower and made agreements that they would Russia would be a supplier to oil to China, and Russia and China would participate together in upstaging the world's financial system, which is built on the U.S. dollar. This is just furtherance of what they started several years ago, and Europe just is caught in the squeeze of that. But Russia has oil, China needs oil, and they want to remake the Western financial system.
Now, Kevin, interestingly enough, I spoke with David Goldman last week about this business of supplanting the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. You and I talk about it most weeks, and I'm interested in getting your current thinking on it, particularly in light of not only what you've just described as the Russian-Chinese campaign in this area, but also what Venezuela has been doing, basically bankrupt country, but working hard, it appears, to secure support of 10 other nations for using their oil-backed cryptocurrency as an alternative to the dollar. Talk about that, and is this just another front in growing economic war against the United States?
Well, it is absolutely another front, and Venezuela is a bankrupt country. They blame the United States. They say we've conducted economic warfare against them, and they've lined up 10 other countries that they believe they're pitching to adopt the new Venezuelan cryptocurrency and to use it as a primary reserve currency. These other 10 countries are mostly in Latin America. They are not major trading partners or threats to the United States in that sense, but it is evidence of a growing effort to displace the dollar by people like Venezuela, which is heavily supported not only by Russia but China. And it has some teeth, not much, but it has some teeth because Venezuela has the largest world oil reserves. Now, they're heavy crude reserves, but we tend to use them in the American economy, and so they have some value that they claim that they're going to back this cryptocurrency with. But they're not alone. Pakistan also has recently said that they're going to drop the dollar for trade with China and use the Chinese yuan instead.
Fascinating developments and very ominous, especially against the backdrop of a clip that has come to our attention, Kevin Freeman, about President Xi Jinping of China addressing some 7,000 Chinese servicemen in what can only be described as a pep talk for war, it seems. You mentioned that the Chinese are clearly preparing not just to engage us economically in a very confrontational way, but perhaps through military means as well. Talk about that, Kevin.
Well, not only just engage the United States, but also to use any turmoil that they could create economically for us as an excuse or opportunity for them to invade Taiwan or any of the other neighbors that they insist are part of China anyway. And I've seen an unveiling of a landing craft that would be capable of invading Taiwan. Then you have President Xi Jinping talking about, really inciting, we're getting ready for war. There is no doubt in my mind that they are following the unrestricted warfare blueprint of 1999. They've gone through the early economic phases of growing growing their economy. Now they're in the phases of challenging our economy. And the next phase is actually using military force to take advantage of any weakness they can create in us. So this is war.
This is war, an ominous place to leave this conversation, but we will be discussing, I know, with you and others in the days ahead, Kevin, the full dimensions of this, and most especially what the United States had best be doing right now, both with respect to its economic capabilities and warfare instruments, as well as the old-fashioned kind of national defense. It's time that we do that, and perhaps past time. Kevin Freeman, we appreciate your efforts and good work at globaleconomicwarfare.com, as well as with us at the Center for Security Policy. Thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to resuming our conversation next one.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by one of the men that I have come to admire most in official Washington. He has been for many years the corporate memory of the United States government, and now out of government at the National Institute for Public Policy, where he's a senior fellow providing a similar function. He is Dr. Mark Schneider, extraordinary resource on matters involving, well, all aspects of national security, really, but most especially nuclear deterrence, missile defenses, and arms control. I had the privilege of working with Mark a lifetime ago in the Pentagon. He went on to do enormously important work as a Foreign Service officer at the State Department and the Defense Department. And it's a great pleasure to have him with us to take stock of some of the things that are now getting an awful lot of attention, and properly so, but I'm hoping it's informed attention. So to that end, Mark, welcome. Good to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to start, Mark, with the recent upset that occurred in the aftermath of an erroneous warning to the people of Hawaii about an imminent ballistic missile attack. The screaming and yelling that's going on at the moment about having disturbed the people of Hawaii unnecessarily, and it's not to say that it wasn't a mistake and it shouldn't have been done, but it does seem to me to be a bit like the caterwauling that you might have expected the emperor, who was discovered to have no clothes, exhibited when it was pointed out to him. The problem, it seems, Mark, is that we don't have much that we can offer the people of Hawaii, or for that matter, the people of this country more generally, should a missile attack be launched upon us. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes. I mean, we have some capability to defend Hawaii from Alaska, but it's not good enough to deal with all the threats. The idea of defending the country from one or two sites is not a particularly good idea, even if in theory you can make it work. You'd want to have a local defense site in Hawaii because it will maximize the probability of you being able to intercept a missile or missiles aimed at Hawaii. But what I think, I mean, obviously this was some bureaucrat in Hawaii that sent this notice out, but it really drives home the importance of missile defense. If this was real, wouldn't the people of Hawaii want it to have a missile defense system or the maximum amount of missile defense system that they could have? I think they will, and that's what we should be doing, and not only in Hawaii.
Yeah. Mark, there are two other pieces to this that I also want to cover with you. We'll come to the nuclear deterrent aspect because that's, of course, part of the backdrop of what we need to do to prevent attacks upon our country. But before we get there, Mark, one of the other things that I think proved very stressful for a lot of people in Hawaii who responded to this warning that this is no drill, take cover, was that there is essentially no civil defense in place in this country at this point. I mean, there's some sort of vestigial remnants, I guess, of what there was there during the Cold War. But what have we done in that regard, Mark? And is that generally the practice of other countries who we, among other things, need to deter at the moment?
We certainly largely abandoned civil defense against a foreign threat after the end of the Cold War.
Arguably long before that ended, actually. I think around the time of the ABM Treaty, wasn't it?
Yeah, there wasn't much long before that. If you compare our capabilities with Russia, it's not even a pale reflection of what they had. You had the Soviet system, which was building a nationwide blast shelter construction program, and now that's been revived under Vladimir Putin.
For both the leadership and the party elite and the key workforce, as well as the larger population, Mark?
Yes, that's what's being reported now, both in the Russian media and by Bill Gertz. And certainly there is not a remote comparison between the type of national command authority survivability that exists in Russia and what we have in the United States. I mean, we call our system the nuclear thin line, and it's probably the greatest, you know, Freudian slip in history, because that's exactly what it is.
Very thin line. Yeah. Mark, let me turn to the nuclear deterrent piece of this. You have spent your professional life studying the various threats to this country in terms of nuclear arsenals around the world. You've also, of course, been closely monitoring the condition of our own. You've described a pale comparison between the Russian and U.S. civil defense programs, for example. How would you describe at this point the adequacy of our nuclear deterrent vis-a-vis certainly the first line threats we're facing, Russia, China, and the like, but perhaps even in dissuading a North Korea from undertaking an attack?
Well, we face a critical crisis in defense generally in the country today. Obama left us in a position where our readiness, our ability to fight high-intensity conflict was dramatically reduced from what he inherited, and the situation in the nuclear deterrence area is worse. You had, in the last year or two of Obama, a major turnaround in the Defense Department on this issue. And to their credit, under Ash Carter, they said a lot of very important and very useful things about the need, the threat that exists, and the need to do something about it. Unfortunately, under Obama, virtually nothing was done about it.
So, Mark, this brings us to the Trump administration, of course. We've got a new nuclear posture review underway. I'm told it's likely to emerge here shortly. Interestingly enough, there's a companion piece, the Ballistic Missile Defense Review, as well. Do you have any insights into whether these are going to wind up to be, again, more evidence of rhetoric without action, or will they constitute a real blueprint for trying to remedy the situation we're facing with an inadequate deterrent at the moment?
Well, what is purported to be a draft or late draft of the Nuclear Posture Review was leaked to the left late last week. It's available on the internet. I don't know if it's real or not, but my perception is it's too good not to be real. The analysis in it is first rate. It's the best threat assessment out of the U.S. government we've seen since the 1980s. The analysis of deterrence in it is probably the best in the country's history. I've never seen anything like it in a government document. It's fabulous. It talks about the problems and serious problems we have in the nuclear deterrent area. It has recommendations in it that appear very useful. As a matter of fact, some of them, like the low-yield warhead for the Trident and the nuclear Slicum, I've made personally. The question is, are we doing enough? And I think we have to look at the details when they come out. They certainly are say in the draft text that they're addressing the problems. There's some dates and timelines in it. I'm a little concerned about the pit production They plan to resume pit production at potentially a rate of 80 a year by 2030. Look, I mean, World War II, we went from nothing to the atomic bomb and everything you needed to build one in 4 years. So 12 years seems a long time for me.
And we may not have that time. Mark Schneider, this is an incredibly important conversation, and I'm always appreciative of your time and look forward to continuing it often in 2018. We'll look forward to your assessment of the real NPR when it comes out, and we'll link to the existing document that is now out there and the hopes that it will prove to be authentic and not just a good blueprint, but one that is implemented. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.